Today is Thursday, November 20th, and this is the World Socialist Website. For a rank-and-file inquiry into the deaths of USPS workers Nick Acker and Russell Scruggs, Jr., a statement of the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees. The International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, or IWA-RFC, calls for an independent inquiry led by rank-and-file workers into the deaths of Nick Acker and Russell Scruggs, Jr., at two separate U.S. postal facilities in the past 2 weeks. We urge postal workers with relevant information to come forward with testimony. This is necessary to expose the brutal conditions facing postal workers, which are part of the industrial slaughterhouse that has become daily life for workers across the United States and the world. On November 8th, at the Detroit Network Distribution Center in Allen Park, Michigan, Nick Acker was killed by a mail sorting machine that he was performing maintenance on. His body was not recovered for 8 hours, and then only after his wife came to pick him up. Workers report that a grievance had been filed on the machine, whose safety features were allegedly disabled, in order to keep operations moving. On Saturday, November 15th, Russell Scruggs, Jr. died after falling and hitting his head at the Palmetto Processing and Distribution Center in Georgia. Workers say the lack of cell phone service in the facility and the lack of emergency protocols inside the plant contributed to his death because of a lengthy delay in providing him with medical attention. In both cases, management kept operations running, according to reports from workers in the facilities. These preventable tragedies have lifted the veil on the brutal conditions at USPS. Allen Park workers say the facility is a, quote, death trap, unquote. Palmetto workers pointed to the death of 59-year-old Eric Smith in June, as well as two recent suicides off-site. Last year, 48-year-old Shannon Barnes also died at the facility. These deaths are only some of the latest in an unending series of workplace disasters in the United States. The UPS cargo plane crash on November 4th in Louisville, Kentucky, killed 14 people. A recent catastrophic explosion at a Tennessee munitions plant killed 16. An ammonia leak on November 14th in Oklahoma sent 34 to the hospital. An explosion at the Clairton Steel Mill near Pittsburgh in August killed 2 and injured 10. There have been at least 5 deaths among postal workers this year. This includes 2 letter carriers, Dan Workman of Grand Junction, Colorado, and Jacob Taylor of Dallas, Texas, and apparent heat-related incidents. The IWA-RFC has already launched an inquiry into the death of auto worker Ronald Adams Sr., who worked at the Stellantis Dundee engine plant in southeast Michigan. Adams was crushed to death while performing maintenance in circumstances apparently similar to those that killed Acker. A meeting with initial findings was held on July 27. At the meeting, it was reported that the bypassing of lockout-tagout procedures by management, an elementary safety measure, likely played a significant role. Also in June, the USPS Workers' Rank-and-File Committee, which is part of the IWA-RFC, issued a call for an investigation into the deaths of Workman and Taylor. The work of the IWA-RFC must be expanded. This is not a journalistic exercise, but an effort to arm workers with the knowledge they need to defend themselves and go on the offensive against the regime of corporate dictatorship in the workplaces, which makes these deaths inevitable. The slaughterhouse is covered up by the corporate media. It is also covered up by the trade union bureaucracy, which has done nothing to protect workers and functions as an arm of management. The American Postal Workers Union has remained silent on this month's deaths. Workers report that it is complicit in Acker's death because of the outstanding grievance filed only a few weeks prior. This situation is the universal experience of the working class. At UPS, The Teamsters are helping carry out tens of thousands of job cuts. In the auto industry, the United Auto Workers has done nothing about Adam's death, while not lifting a finger as thousands are laid off. This is why the investigation must be taken up by workers themselves in a rank-and-file inquiry. No amount of pressure will compel the bureaucracy to do anything, because they are part of the problem. A critical issue is the role played by relentless cost-cutting. The USPS is in the midst of the Delivering for America, or DFA, restructuring program, begun under Trump's first term and continued under Biden, aimed at making the post office profitable along Amazon-style lines and preparing the ground for its eventual privatization. It involves closing 1,000 local offices, consolidating tens of thousands of routes, and concentrating operations into a smaller number of large automated facilities requiring far fewer workers. Invasive new monitoring systems for city carriers are being used to automatically write workers up for quote-unquote stationary events. This contributed to the death of Dallas carrier Eugene Gates in 2023. Among rural carriers, workers have long been forced to labor on a kind of piece rate system. Reevaluation of the value of their routes slashed pay for two-thirds, often by $10,000 and even $20,000 a year. The DFA program is supported by the National Association of Letter Carriers, or NALC, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, or NRLCA, unions, which also signed side agreements to implement pay cuts and monitoring over the opposition of workers. DFA's implementation has been chaotic, with medical test results and other key mail reported delayed for weeks. According to one Palmetto worker, management cleans up the facility when media or congresspeople show up in response to public outcry, only for things to go back to normal afterward. Post offices are under attack in every country. Massive cuts are underway at Canada Post. Royal Mail is being acquired by billionaire Daniel Kretinsky. Deutsche Post was privatized years ago, and Brazilian postal workers are facing around 10,000 layoffs as part of a privatization plan. The same conditions are mirrored across every industry. U.S. companies have cut 1.1 million jobs this year, the highest number since the Great Recession. Corporations are salivating over the use of AI and other technologies to wipe out tens of millions of jobs. There is a fundamental contradiction in the use of these labor-saving technologies, which could be used to address the cost of living crisis and make the workplace safer, but instead are being used to turn back the clock on working conditions to the 19th century. This process is enabled by the complete integration of the corporate oligarchy and the government. David Steiner, the new Postmaster General, is a board member of FedEx. David Keeling, the new head of OSHA, or Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is a former safety chief at UPS and Amazon, both notorious low-wage sweatshops. The ruling class is shutting down safety agencies, cutting off food stamps and Medicaid to tens of millions, and destroying anything which even remotely protects workers from injury and destitution. The history of the post office shows that resistance depends on the initiative of the rank and file. The 1970 National Postal Strike was a wildcat strike in defiance of the postal union bureaucrats against earlier attacks by Nixon. The spirit of resistance must find new outlets. New organizations, rank-and-file committees, must be built, combining democratic control and organization with the rebellion against the union apparatus. This must be based on a strategy of uniting the working class all over the world to fight for what workers urgently need, not what management is willing to give. On Sunday, the IWA-RFC held a meeting on mass layoffs, addressed by workers across industries. In the opening report, WSWS writer Tom Hall explained that the layoffs were part of a war on the working class. On Monday, the IWA-RFC issued a statement explaining that, quote, "The solution of the working class must be the development of a network of rank-and-file committees in every industry and workplace to bring the force of the working class to bear against the entrenched power of the oligarchy. The time has come to take a stand. An independent investigation into the deaths of Nick Acker, Russell Scruggs Jr., and other postal workers will become a spearhead for the fight to empower rank-and-file committees to take control of safety conditions, guarantee the right to life, health, and safety on the job, and end the dictatorship of production for profit. Join the inquiry by contacting us via the WSWS.org website. Debt now moving to the center of the AI boom by Nick Beams. There is now widespread recognition that the artificial intelligence or AI boom, which has powered Wall Street to record highs, has taken a significant turn with major implications for financial markets and possibly the entire economy. When the AI boom began at the end of 2022 with the release by OpenAI of ChatGPT, it was chiefly financed through the massive cash flows of the so-called hyperscalers, such as Google, Microsoft, Meta, and Amazon, together with the chip-making firm NVIDIA. Little debt was involved, but in what is increasingly becoming a war, as major tech giants strive to place themselves in the best position, this is now changing, and debt must be increasingly used to finance AI development. In a recent article, Sydney Morning Herald economics columnist Stephen Bartholomews pointed to the significance of the shift. He wrote, quote, "Until now, questioning of the boom in investment in artificial intelligence has largely been confined to whether it constitutes a stock market bubble. Increasingly, the conversation will shift to whether that boom represents a threat to financial system stability," unquote. Massive amounts of money are involved. According to the global management consulting firm McKinsey, some $5.2 trillion will be needed by 2030 to finance the building of the data centers which are needed to develop the computing power for AI. This amount is equivalent to 3 times the annual GDP of Australia. Morgan Stanley estimates that between this year and 2028, the capital spending on AI infrastructure will be $2.9 trillion, of which $1.5 trillion will be financed externally, including $800 billion from private credit sources. Apart from the money involved, the scale of AI data centers is indicated by their power consumption. The International Energy Agency has estimated that electricity demand from AI data centers worldwide will more than double by 2030, and reach a level higher than the electricity consumption of Japan, the world's fourth largest economy. Last month, OpenAI announced plans for a major data center in Michigan, which, according to a report in the Financial Times, will consume as much electricity as 44.2 million households. Other operations are on the same scale. Another expression of their extent is revealed by the estimate that an increase of just 1 cent per kilowatt hour for a company using 50 megawatts annually would be around $4.4 million. There are an increasing number of concerns being raised about the potential triggers for the collapse of the AI boom and its consequences. The most obvious one is the enormous gulf between the spending on infrastructure and the revenue being generated. OpenAI has signed deals amounting to $1.5 trillion, but its revenue for this year is expected to be just $20 billion. If it is going to go anywhere near meeting its commitments to acquire chips, then that will have to be raised to the hundreds of billions of dollars. Summing up the overall situation, a recent article in the Wall Street Journal noted that chief among the real reasons to be concerned about the sustainability of the boom, quote, is that there is far more AI computing infrastructure spending than there is AI revenue, a gulf that is widening by the day. The business consulting firm Bain has estimated that $2 trillion in revenue will be required by 2030 to sustain the investments that have been made, compared to $253 billion in 2024. Another issue is the short life cycle of chips, which can be as little as 3 years. This means that the value of the asset backing the massive loans used to finance the data center will be rapidly depreciated as they become redundant, requiring new expenditures to remain competitive. In a blog post issued last month, the Bank of England said there was a range of developments that could trigger a reevaluation of future revenues and AI asset prices. These included, but were not limited to, quote, underwhelming speed of AI capability progress and user adoption of AI, or below expectation ability of AI companies to monetize the users of their AI applications, unquote, with the speed of AI progress and impact, quote, highly uncertain. For companies that depend on massive computation capacity to run their AI models, quote, algorithmic breakthrough or other events which challenge that paradigm could cause a significant reevaluation of asset prices. As an example, it cited the introduction of a new model by the Chinese startup firm DeepSeek in January at a lower cost and with a more efficient use of computing power, which triggered a fall in the stock price of AI companies in the U.S. A reevaluation of asset prices means a reevaluation of the debt structure which has been used to finance them, with the potential to cause problems for the lenders, to which the BOE blog pointed, quoting, if the projected scale of debt-financed AI and associated energy infrastructure investments materializes over this decade, financial stability risks are likely to grow. Banks would be exposed to this directly through their credit exposures to AI companies, as well as indirectly through their provision of loans and credit facilities to private credit funds and other financial institutions which are exposed to AI-impacted asset prices, unquote. In his comment piece, which we cited previously, Bartholomews said that for the moment, quote, discussions about an AI bubble are largely confined to the share market and to the paper losses that would flow if it burst, unquote. In such discussions, the comparison is often made with the bursting of the dot-com bubble at the start of the century, which, while it had a major impact on the companies involved, did not spark a broader financial crisis or a deep recession. Such reassurances, however, are entirely misplaced because of the major transformations in the U.S. financial system and economy over the past quarter century, above all the expansion of debt. In 2000, total U.S. debt, public and private, was $28.64 trillion. At the end of last year, 2024, it was $102.21 trillion. The Bank of England warned that a fall in AI-related assets could adversely impact U.S. growth under conditions where AI investment, quote, has been an outsized driver of U.S. GDP growth in the first half of 2025. It noted that while the collapse of the dot-com bubble did contribute to a mild recession, a, quote, fall in AI-related asset prices would happen in a significantly different macroeconomic context to the early 2000s. According to calculations by former International Monetary Fund leading economist Geeta Gopinath, a collapse in the AI market equivalent to the bursting of the dot-com bubble would cause U.S. investors to lose $20 trillion, an amount equivalent to 70% of American GDP, and deliver a $15 trillion hit to the rest of the world, equivalent to 20% of its GDP. Given the growing involvement of the banks and finance capital more broadly in the AI boom, and the ever-increasing role of debt in funding historically unprecedented levels of capital spending as each of the tech giants seeks to dominate AI, such a development would signify not just the bursting of a bubble, but potentially a collapse of the entire financial system. That prospect, looming ever larger, which would go far beyond the devastation resulting from the financial crisis of 2008, has far-reaching political implications. There is no doubt that the rationally planned, conscious, and democratically controlled development of AI would provide for an advance of humanity in the economy and so many other areas of social life. However, AI is not being advanced in such a manner, but within the social relations of capitalism, based on the private ownership of the means of production and finance subject to the anarchy of the market and the striving of corporate giants for profit. The process now unfolding recalls the central thesis of the founder of scientific socialism, Karl Marx, when he explained that the objective possibility, indeed necessity, for the socialist transformation of society arose when, quote, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production, unquote. That contradiction is now assuming an acute form. AI, which could provide enormous economic advances for the mass of humanity, is already being used as a battering ram against the working class in the form of mass layoffs and the intensification of exploitation. At the same time, under capitalism, the mechanisms for its development are creating the conditions for a devastating economic and financial crisis. There is only one way forward. That is the conscious political struggle by the working class, the producers of all wealth, including AI, for the overthrow of the capitalist oligarchy and the socialist transformation of society, so that the enormous potential contained within AI for social advancement can be realized. Congress, CEOs, Follow Trump, and Welcome to Saudi Butcher by Patrick Martin. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman met with top congressional leaders of both parties Wednesday morning before an hours-long session with corporate CEOs and billionaires at the Kennedy Center in the afternoon. The events confirm that President Trump spoke for the entire ruling class, Democrats and Republicans alike, when he welcomed the bloodstained monarch to the White House and denounced any mention of bin Salman's role in the gruesome murder of Saudi dissident and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Particularly noteworthy was the attendance of the House and Senate leaders of the Democratic Party, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, at a reception for bin Salman at the Capitol, followed by a tour of the building. They were joined by Representative Gregory Meeks, Democrat of New York, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and the House and Senate Republican leadership. The reception was intentionally low-key, with no notice to the press, no opportunity to take photographs, and, likely the main consideration, no opportunity for those opposed to the Saudi regime in its collaboration with Zionism and American imperialism to stage protests against the appearance of the murderous ruler at the Capitol. At a press briefing later Wednesday, Jeffries did not even mention the meeting with bin Salman until he was asked directly about it by a reporter. Jeffries answered, quote, I was part of the bipartisan meeting hosted by the speaker this morning. I asked the Crown Prince about his views relative to a just and lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinian people, and his views as it relates to the importance of a two-state solution. The Crown Prince reiterated his view that a one-state solution in Israel is impractical, and that the best path forward, of course, involving the reconstruction of Gaza, is to eventually find a robust path toward a safe and secure Israel, living side by side in peace and prosperity with a Palestinian state. I support that decision, unquote. Jeffries went on to declare his support for, quote, the special relationship between our two countries, it's incredibly important. And he praised the Saudi leader for his commitment to self-determination for the Palestinian people, a right which is entirely denied to the population of Saudi Arabia living under the despotic monarchy. The reporter had to press Jeffries to elicit any response about bin Salman's brutal history of violent repression. Quote, was Jamal Khashoggi mentioned at all, or his murder? Jeffries replied, quote, it wasn't mentioned in the conversations that I was a part of, unquote. Representative Meeks, the other House Democrat, known to have attended the get-together with Bin Salman, told reporters later that the Trump administration should brief Congress on any agreements reached during the Saudi leader's visit, and voice concerns about conflicts of interest involving the Trump Organization, the family business run by Trump's two oldest sons, Don Jr. and Eric. Meeks is a key advocate within Congress for the military intelligence apparatus of U.S. imperialism. He was part of the congressional delegation that visited Taiwan in August 2022, headed by then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in a show of support for the regime on the island that deliberately undermined the long-standing One China policy, which acknowledges that Taiwan is part of China. Several Senate Democrats who did not attend the reception for Bin Salman criticized Trump's embrace of the Saudi despot because he was rejecting the assessment made by the CIA that the Crown Prince had ordered Khashoggi's murder. These include Jeannie Shaheen, ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate in the 2016 presidential election. Kaine criticized Trump's disregard for the CIA assessment of the Khashoggi murder, suggesting that it undermined the interests of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. He said in a statement, quote, "Instead of rolling out the red carpet for MBS and leveraging the presidency for private hotel deals, Trump should be demanding accountability on behalf of Khashoggi's Virginia-based family and pressing Saudi Arabia to advance U.S. security interests," unquote. There is nothing surprising about the welcoming of the Saudi despot and mass murderer to the U.S. Capitol. The House and Senate have given standing ovations to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on at least two occasions during the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has addressed a joint session of Congress twice, even as he pursued policies of entrenching his authoritarian Hindu supremacist regime and threatening nuclear war against neighboring Pakistan. British Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed Congress at the height of the U.S.-British War of Conquest in Iraq in July 2003. More importantly, American presidents themselves address Congress on a regular basis, and the war crimes committed by these presidents in this century alone, wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, drone missile assassinations from the Middle East to the Caribbean, dwarf those committed by any visiting monarchs, dictators, or prime ministers. After his brief session, schmoozing with the congressional leadership, Bin Salman traveled across town to the Kennedy Center to resume the real business of his trip, wooing and being wooed by corporate CEOs and billionaires, with Trump presiding over the scene like the head pimp at a house of ill repute. The crowd attending the Kennedy Center spectacle was at least four times as large as the number who dined at the East Room of the White House Tuesday night. Trump complained during that dinner that he could have invited a much larger number if his reconstruction of the east wing of the building were completed, including a huge ballroom with a seating capacity in the thousands. There were no protests in this milieu over Bin Salman's bloody record. On the contrary, his corporate well-wishers no doubt envy his ability not just to fire critics, as is the practice in giant corporations, but to put them literally to the sword. While a few individual reporters have raised the Khashoggi assassination only to attract bullying from Trump, their bosses in the corporate media have downplayed the issue, even in the two newspapers most identified with the Democratic Party, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Both newspapers published editorials Wednesday criticizing Trump's embrace of Bin Salman, but hedged about with professions of support for Trump's foreign policy in the Middle East, and particularly his all-out support of Israel. The Times editorial began with a depiction of the United States as a democracy, forced to ally with murderers like Bin Salman by, quote, "the realities of geopolitics." But the central reality of geopolitics is that American imperialism is itself the most murderous force on the planet. It attracts the support of jackals like Bin Salman, who seek a share in the spoils provided by the biggest and most violent predator among imperialist powers. Like Kane, the Times criticized Trump for discarding, quote, the hard work of American intelligence, unquote, in investigating the Khashoggi murder, while complaining mildly that, quote, the president showed open disdain for the principles of press freedom enshrined in the Constitution, unquote. The editorial went on to describe bin Salman as, quote, a complicated dictator, unquote, that is, a dictator with a good side, without bothering to connect that assessment to Trump's ongoing effort to set himself up as a president dictator. As for the Post, owned by billionaire Jeff Bezos, it could barely summon up the energy to condemn Trump's gangster remark about the murder of Khashoggi, that, quote, things happen, unquote. Khashoggi regularly criticized bin Salman on the Post's op-ed page. Suppressing that criticism was the motive for his murder inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. The Post editorial began by declaring, quote, the U.S. government often advances its national interests by working with nasty people, and Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is one of the nastiest, unquote. It went on to criticize Trump, not for making deals with bin Salman, but for being too effusive in his public embrace. But it concluded, quote, Trump has an unconventional foreign policy that can achieve unexpected results. See Gaza. But it's possible to protect U.S. interests without insulting Khashoggi's memory, unquote. The Post editors, in their scent to billionaire owner, object to Trump spitting on the grave of Khashoggi, but they support far greater and more terrible crimes. The U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza, which has killed tens, even hundreds of thousands, mainly women and children. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.